From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is Dr. Ewan Ashley, who's just written The Genome Odyssey, Medical Mysteries and the Incredible Quest to Solve Them. Since the Human Genome Project was completed in 2003, the price of genome sequencing has dropped at a staggering rate. It's as if the price of a Ferrari went from $350,000 to a mere 40 cents. And through breakthroughs by Dr. Ashley's team at Stanford and other dedicated groups around the world, analyzing the human genome has increased from a heroic multi-billion dollar effort to a single clinical test costing less than $1,000 today. Dr. Ashley, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's really great to be here. I'm so excited to be on a show called Cool Science Radio.
Oh, well, Dr. Ashley, we are delighted to have you. We very much enjoyed your book. Maybe we can start by you kind of unpacking this just a little for us. The molecule DNA, what does it stand for? What is in that molecule? And what does it tell us about each of us as individuals?
Yeah, DNA, well, many people have heard the letters, but deoxyribonucleic acid is the mouthful that describes the molecule, and it's really the molecule of life. And what it comes down to at the end of the day is essentially a number of sugars that are stuck on basically and called nucleotides. And they're called nucleotides partly because the DNA is in the nucleus, that's the central core of almost every cell in your body. But the importance of those particular sugars is that they correspond to a letter, an A, a T, a G, or a C. And basically your genome, which is 6 billion letters, is and every single one of those letters is basically one of those, an A, a T, or G, or a C. And that code, kind of a secret code that is absolutely unique to every single one of you, is buried in that central core of almost every cell in your body. And this is a code that connects every one of us to every other of us, connects us to every other living organism on Earth. The code in some ways contains the history of the human race, and it certainly tells us a lot about health and disease, which is a lot of the focus that we go into in the Genome Odyssey.
And you write in your book, and this is fascinating, I go to the doctor, I get a blood panel workup, I get a cholesterol test, for an example, it's about 5 numbers. The genome is 6 billion. So what does that, you know, how does a healthcare professional, you know, what do they do with 6 billion numbers versus 5? And what do Lynn and I do with our genomic sequencing?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, medicine is really lives in a sort of lower throughput world. And as a cardiologist myself, I'm used to sending cholesterol panels and getting 4 or 5 numbers back. And about 10 years ago, which is the point at which the book begins, we realized that this genome, as you mentioned, was going from a cost that was just prohibitive. Like the first one cost $3 billion, the Human Genome Project. But over the course of the last 20 years, now you can get a genome for $500. So that data is potentially available to anyone for whom it might be helpful. And if increasingly, you know, rare and genetic disease, but increasingly that will be everyone. And the question then is, what do you do with in the healthcare with six billion letters? And that's what a lot of the stories in the book link to, how we started to build tools to try to help doctors understand the genome and be able to incorporate it. If you think of a primary care visit where you might have 12 minutes, how could the genome of 6 billion letters possibly be relevant for that or be used? So we've tried over the years to build tools to help integrate the genome into medicine. And one of the ways we've done it is, one example, if you go to your doctor and ask about risk for heart disease, they might ask you about smoking or cholesterol or diabetes. What we want to do and what we're doing just over the course of these few years is integrating that genomic data into that same prediction. It gives you a prediction of your chance of a heart attack in the next few years, and that prediction is used to make decisions about things like cholesterol medication. So what we need to do, given that we know that heart disease is both nature and nurture, is basically include the nature part, which we haven't really been doing to date, by including the genome, but not in a way that makes it complicated for the physician who has this, you know, 12 minutes, but rather just include the genetic information in that prediction so that's kind of under the hood.
You know, Dr. Ashley, this is the 30th anniversary of the Hubble Space Telescope, and it kind of reminds me back in the 1600s when you look through Galileo's smudged, imperfect, handmade lenses, right, and you can barely see this little baby moon going around Jupiter, and a lot of people didn't think it was a moon except Galileo did. And now we have this Hubble. It almost likens itself to that type of comparison. We are shining a bright light on life, aren't we?
I think we really are, yeah. And I often use that analogy, which is to say that the genome provides us a molecular microscope, basically shining a bright light into all the corners of the genome. And that's the amazing thing, that because your genome doesn't change, if you get the sequence together and you have it, so let's say on file with your doctor, then as the genetic knowledge improves, potentially more and more insights can be applied to your health without doing any more testing. That's the kind of amazing thing about it.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Dr. Ewan Angus Ashley. He's a professor of medicine and genetics at Stanford University. He's written a new book called The Genome Odyssey, Medical Mysteries and the Incredible Quest to Solve Them. You know what it brings up for me is that when we go to our doctors and we can't figure out what's wrong with us, and there are our tests, but then we often hear, and maybe it's a bit of an excuse, medicine is an art, not a science. What your book tells me that we have a lot of hope here for medicine being a science and less of an art. Isn't that right?
I think that's exactly right. And we call this new ability to shine this bright light on these mystery diseases precision medicine. And I think that's a good title, because we really are trying to be more precise about understanding. If you think back into the history of medicine, we've used the tools that we had at the time to help define the diseases we had. So when we just had a stethoscope, then the diseases were really defined by what we could hear in our ears. And then in certain areas, if you think about the heart, we got an electrocardiogram where we could read the electrical activity of the heart. And so we started to think about the electrical activity of the heart. But now we have this molecular microscope that can really dive deeply in. And a lot of the work we've done with it is to apply it to those patients, as you mentioned, who go from doctor to doctor to doctor without really any answers. They have mysterious syndromes, some of the hardest cases in medicine. And what we found is that by applying the genome to those individuals, we're able in a significant number of cases, like 30 or 40% of the time, to find an answer. Mm-hmm. And most of the time when we find that answer, it's an answer that actually points at an action, which means is to say that sometimes there's a therapy we can choose that we didn't know was available before. Other times we're able to change things for the family, or potentially for sure stop all the testing that was leading up to the point of not finding any answers.
Right, because anyone who's ever been through that with a loved one or been through it themselves know just how frustrating it is to get test after test after test with no answers. I wanted to mention that, you know, when we hear that, you know, the average lay person, not a geneticist like you, hears about sequencing the human genome, it sounds a little bit overwhelming, even though we know it signals something good and hopeful. But what you do in your book that I so appreciate is you tell stories, and stories are something that we can all relate to. So I wanted to ask about the story that you start your book with, Patient Zero, Little Parker.
Yeah, yeah. And well, for me, I spent my life, even before I was into technology and loving of genetics, I knew I wanted to be a doctor. And so part of that, I think, was driven from my youngest age by wanting to help people, but also understanding that everybody is living their own story. And what I was trying to do with the book, and I really appreciate your remarks, was to try to bring this technology, if you like, to life, and by putting it in the context of different patients. And yeah, we start out the book, and throughout the book, there are stories of patients we've just been really privileged to find and have come to us. We run a network called the Undiagnosed Diseases Network for many of these cases. Yeah, and little Parker was one of those examples. And he had not been developing normally, and his mom had been really stressed about that. And like many other patients, had taken him from one doctor to another. And increasingly sophisticated testing, even genetic testing that had not been able to find an answer. And this is the case because every individual is unique and not all patients present exactly as the textbook would say they should. But by applying the genome, we're able to shine this bright light that we mentioned and be able to look across every gene in the genome. And in his case, we found a mutation in a gene called FOXG1, which was able to solve the condition and immediately let both his mom know what she was dealing with. You know, what's the size and shape of the enemy here? Because that's one of the hardest things about undiagnosed diseases, that you have these symptoms and the challenges for the families, but without a name, it's very hard to know what to do and to attack. And even when people ask you, well, what's wrong, you don't have anything to tell them. But by giving a diagnosis, then suddenly there's a community of other people. And Lynn Parker's mom is very active in the Facebook group now for FOXG1 patients. They were able to understand the doctors, what they're dealing with, and give the right therapies at the right time for the patient. So we're really happy to be able to bring this kind of technology forward. But at the end of the day, the technology is being applied in the context of a single human trying to make their story better.
And as Lynn said, these stories are wonderful. One of the other stories that you tell me, there's a number of stories in the book, but you talk about a little girl while still in her mother's womb was found to have a heart rate about half what it should have been. Her name is Jazlene. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, absolutely. So she first came to our attention, as you mentioned, when she was still in the womb, 36 weeks of gestation. And we transferred her over to Stanford Hospital and a children's hospital. She was delivered by cesarean. When she came out, we realized that what we first thought might be the case, she might have a heart block causing her heart rate to be low, was not the case. She actually had a rare genetic syndrome called long QT syndrome. And that refers to the resetting. The QT is the resetting of the heart rate with each beat. And that the heart rate itself isn't so much the issue as the fact she's predisposed to dangerous heart rhythms. And in fact, on the first day of her young life, she had 5 cardiac arrests. So her heart stopped 5 times. And 5 times she had to have CPR. We realized that if we were able to work out what the genetic basis of the disease was, we could give her precise therapy. We were just talking about precision medicine. But at the time, the normal genetic testing took 3 months to come back and cost $5,000. She just didn't have that kind of time. So we worked closely with a sequencing company called Illumina and some colleagues there who managed to turn around the genome over the course of just a few days. And a few days later, we were able to find the answer and start giving her the precise therapy for this condition. And I was happy to say that several years later, I mentioned this in the book, she's actually now doing really well and has survived this initial drama in her life, hopefully with no memory of it, if we're lucky.
Well, this was early on in the process, and thanks to you, I think you called a lot of favors and put some pressure on people to get involved and do all of this. Was it as simple as turning a gene off once you observed that there were these two genes that were contributing to this?
Yeah, in her case, we weren't able to apply genetic therapy. In the latter part of the book, I do talk about this new world of gene therapy or genetic therapy that's coming, and many of your listeners may have heard of CRISPR and gene editing. And That's certainly coming, and it's very exciting. We don't have that available for everyone yet, but what we do have is a long history of drug development where we have lots of medications, but we don't always understand which medications work well for which patients. And that's partly because we don't understand for each condition exactly which subgroup of patients really benefits. And long QT syndrome that Jazlene suffered from actually is a great example of that, because it was first found in the 1800s. It wasn't described as long QT till the electrocardiogram was invented about 100 years later. But what happened in the 1990s and beyond is that we started to understand specific genes were mutated, and so we could break it up into many more subconditions. And those subconditions can then be targeted with the precise therapy. And that's what we were able to do in her case.
That's so fascinating. You know, going back to John's intro for you, Dr. Ashley, and talking about, you know, comparing what it would have cost to the cost of a Ferrari and now what genetic testing costs, I still don't, you know, when I go see my primary care physician, he doesn't say to me, oh, are you ready to run some genetic testing to see if we can precisely identify things going on with you. So it's not really maybe commonplace yet. And Is that because I don't have some condition that is mysterious going on? Or, you know, when will the average person be able to just do this? And furthermore, how will it be covered by insurance?
Yeah, great question. And so when we first started working, at the point the book starts about 10 years ago on the earliest genomes and trying to think about how they'd be relevant for medicine, I guess we were naive like everyone. We thought, oh, this is going to be available for everyone tomorrow. But of course, it takes time and it's important that people understand the value. Where the value is today and over the last few years is in these people with rare disease, genetic disease, and mystery disease. But what's changing, and it's changing right now, is that that genome is becoming relevant for everyone else. And I often say this, that individually, rare diseases are, of course, individually rare. But collectively, actually, rare diseases are common. One in 15 people has a rare disease. And so that's actually a pretty substantial number of people, first of all. And in fact, coming up next week is Rare Disease Day, where we celebrate and focus on rare disease. But your question really is about the other 14 people out of 15, and that's most people who are at risk of, we're all at risk of heart disease and cancer and many other common conditions like that. And I think it's really exciting. It's taken 10 years, but it's really exciting that coming up over the next few years, we're actually going to make the genome relevant for everyone else. And I gave that example earlier, specifically in relation to heart disease, but it also in relation to cancer. We're going to be using this knowledge of the genome to basically integrate that genetic aspect to predictions, let's say, of your risk for breast cancer or cervical cancer or heart disease through a little tool called the polygenic risk score. This means we take millions of variants across the genome, each with a very small effect, and add them up and then incorporate them with these other predictions. So that is coming, and we're starting to work at Stanford and many other places through what it would take to integrate that into medicine, and exactly as you mentioned, who's going to pay for it.
Absolutely. You had a patient named Leilani who was 12 years old, and she was running on a treadmill in her garage, and her heart just stopped. Thankfully, her mother was able to perform CPR, and long story short, some genetic testing that you conducted discovered two key genetic variants, and four open heart surgeries later, this is how you helped Leilani, well, survive and then thrive. Can you tell that story? I just love to hear these stories.
Yeah, and the stories are what drive me. I just live in awe of what my patients go through, and I wanted to try my best to tell those stories for other people to hear. Yeah, Leilani, we've known for many years. We met her when she was a little older, 16, 17, and by that time she was 3 or 4 years post this first cardiac arrest, and just the most unbelievably brave and courageous and articulate and wonderful human being, but faced with these really unbelievable challenges, which she did not invite. Yeah, as you mentioned, she was running on a treadmill at 12 years old when she suffered the first cardiac arrest. She was protected with a defibrillator. She had several different surgeries for that. And then eventually we realized her heart was failing. One of the reasons for that is that she appeared to have two variants. So most people only have one very rare variant that causes these rare genetic diseases. But in her case, she had two, one from her mom and one from her dad. And so we describe in the book that genetic testing that led us to understand her condition also then led us to make sure we were watching carefully her mom and her dad, since they'd each contributed one variant that each by itself was capable of causing the disease. We also, and I describe this in the book, tested her sister, who was lucky enough to not get either variant. And so there's also that family dynamic that we talk about with these stories. But eventually, because of those two variants, Leilani's heart started to fail and she needed to have a heart transplant. And so I described that story and how in the immediate aftermath of her transplant, things had gone incredibly well. And then after that, there was much more of a winding and tricky, rocky road for her, and just describing her courage in the face of those challenges, even after a heart transplant, is part of the book. In fact, we ended up, in order to test her new heart, taking a little piece of the new heart and sequencing the genome of the new heart to try and understand what was going on with her new heart, even after she had a new one. So just an incredible and unusual story and an incredible and unusual individual.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Ewan Anglis Ashley. He's professor of medicine and genetics at Stanford University. The book he has written, which is fascinating, and we're talking about this morning, The Genome Odyssey, Medical Mysteries and the Incredible Quest to Solve Them. And we're talking about shining a bright light on humans as individuals to understand how they may live and how they may die and even their personality, but taking that light and just shifting it slightly. We are all sort of preoccupied with this new world of viruses. Can we shine a light on these viruses? Can we genomically sequence a virus and build vaccines and understand what's going on better?
Yeah, I mean, we've all, of course, been through just this incredible year when so many things have appeared not to work exactly as they should be, and maybe we've been disappointed with the loss of the response. But one of the incredible silver linings, I think, to the pandemic has been just the amazing ability of science to come to the fore. And ultimately, science, I think, is what's going to save us here. And in fact, genome sequencing is right at the center of that. As you mentioned there, maybe a lot of this was driven, a lot of the technology change might have been driven by the idea that we wanted to sequence the human genome. But what happened in January of last year was that the virus genome was sequenced. Now, we mentioned that our genome was 6 billion base pairs, 6 billion bases, 3 billion base pairs. Well, the genome of the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus is 30,000 bases. And in fact, those are bases of RNA, a related molecule to DNA, a messenger molecule. And so much smaller genome, but small does not mean that it is not capable of causing global disarray, which is what we've seen. But the real power of knowing that sequence is that within hours, we were able to come up with clinical tests that could test an individual with the rather uncomfortable nasal swab, but to say if someone was uninfected or not. And then even more powerfully, as well as the diagnostic test, what we've seen is the ability to dial in these genomic vaccines, because all the leading vaccine contenders are basically based on genomic technology. The ones from Pfizer and Moderna that were developed with BioNTech and the NIH, both essentially based on mRNA, so that RNA technology where we use your own body as essentially a little vaccine factory to build the vaccine inside your body. And they've been just incredibly successful. 100%, every single one of the vaccines has 100% protection against severe disease, hospitalization, and death, which is just unprecedented. And they've been based on this genomic technology. So the ability to sequence the virus, you know, has really moved us forward so much more quickly and allowed us to respond.
And we'll be able to build a booster with this technology that maybe encompasses all of the variants, throw in a couple of shingles vaccines, maybe another influenza vaccine that we think may show up sometime next year. I mean, there's a way of packaging all of this into a single booster. Is that correct?
Well, certainly the idea of what we call multivalent vaccines that can hit multiple targets at once is absolutely a very hot area. But what we've been able to do in the immediate part, and I know that you've been talking about variants on your show, but it's even happening already. Yesterday, Moderna actually shipped the first vaccine that they've already designed. I think they designed it in 30 hours for the new variant that is so prevalent in South Africa that has reduced just a little bit the efficacy of these vaccines. So as you mentioned, yeah, we should be able with this genomic technology to be able to just move vaccination science forward in a really dramatic way, which will have benefits not just for coronavirus that we'll live with for a while, I think, but also flu and many others. So I think it's just an incredibly exciting era to be able to see vaccinations in the genomic era come forward. And the other vaccines that are we heard about J&J in the news yesterday, the AstraZeneca vaccine that was developed with the University of Oxford, also a little different technology, but also based on the genome of the virus and having that genome sequence so early on.
So, Dr. Ashley, this is why when you heard about new strains of the virus, you didn't panic and freak out like the rest of us did, because you knew with just about 30 hours of work, they could change and apply the genomic technology and update the vaccine. Is that right?
Well, that is right. And that wasn't the only reason that I wasn't panicking. I mean, the first one is that for most of the variants that we know about, there is some indication for the one, for example, that was common in the UK that it is a bit more transmissible, although that's actually hard to say definitively. It may also be a little a little harsher from a disease standpoint. But we know that masks, distancing, ventilation, we know all of those things work. I mean, witness the numbers that are falling in the UK and in South Africa in the face of these variants. So that would be the first thing, not reason to panic. We definitely have got this if we can do the mask, distancing, and ventilation. But even more than that, we don't need to worry, because although the South African variant does appear to reduce the efficacy a little bit of the vaccines, as I mentioned, their efficiency starts so high, like 100% for every one of those vaccines I mentioned, that reducing hospitalization and death. So, of course, if it knocks it down a bit, it might knock it down a little bit, but we still are going to have effective vaccines even now. But then, of course, we know that we can design these boosters, which is really, I think, science coming to the fore and really moving at the, you know, almost at the speed of light here for these vaccines to be renewed and for us all to get a booster potentially in the fall before the winter season is upon us.
Before we let you go, I wanted to ask, because it seems like there's so much conflicting information about what really creates herd immunity. So I just wanted to get your take on it.
Yeah, well, I think that the idea is actually a simple one, although it's, and of course the word itself indicates its origin, which it really came from thinking about animals and cattle and others when they're immunized and inoculated. But the idea is simply that in order for a viral infection or bacterial infection to spread, it needs to have a host who's not immune. And so if you think about that at the beginning, a population is naive to, like I say, a new virus, then anyone who gets a large enough dose of the virus is going to be infected, and they can potentially then pass it on to someone else. But now if you think of a situation where, let's say, there's 10 people in a room and they're mingling with each other, but seven of them are already immune, then the virus has to go find just the three people who are not infected in order to spread. And it's much harder for it to spread. And therefore, the chances that it makes it even out of that room are much lower. And that's basically what we're dealing with when we talk about herd immunity. And herd immunity itself, the concept is affected by our behavior. And because if we continue, one of the reasons that people would say that even after the first few people are vaccinated, they should continue to be careful, is because we should continue with our behavior to give the virus the least chance possible of spreading. And if we do that, eventually it gets to the point where there are only these very small little embers, if people think of the infection like a fire, and it's much easier to put out these little embers rather than a big raging fire. So I do think we're moving in that direction. There are 30 million or so documented cases of infection. People estimate 3 to 5 times that people in the country have potentially been infected, and now we're up to almost 50 million people vaccinated. So we're really talking about getting to a point where half to two-thirds of our population in the U.S. has some degree of immunity. And that, I think, is definitely contributing to the slowdown of cases that we're beginning to see, which is really great news for everyone.
Dr. Ewan Angus Ashley, Professor of Medicine and Genetics at Stanford University. The book is The Genome Odyssey, Medical Mysteries and the Incredible Quest to Solve Them. Dr. Ashley, we're talking about an extraordinary technology, but you know what we're really talking about is we're talking about your passion to help people. And that's what this book's all about. And so we want to thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll come back, because we'd like to talk to you again.
Oh, I'd love to do that. And thank you so much for having me today and for your very kind words.
Okay. Best of luck with your book. Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening. And hey, tune in next week.